Welcome to Sideburn, a part of the Third Degree Burn podcast family. In this episode, we are continuing coverage of X-Men: The Hidden Years with issues 17 and 18. In the show, we're exploring the run of the book written and drawn by John Byrne in the early 2000s. I'm John Hyatt, and here with me is Nigel Spink. Hi, Nigel.
Hello, John. Hi.
Hey, this is great to be back with you to talk about X-Men Hidden Years 17 and 18. We're continuing on, and I think it's getting to an interesting part. Finalize the Savage Land kind of storyline and all of those other things, and now we're right into a whole new interesting story plot. What do you think?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, as you say, I think we're finally done with the Savage Land at last. Now we're on to other ventures following some sad storyline. If you remember, people listening, Warren's mother died recently in one of our last coverages, so it was a bit of a sad story.
Yeah, that was definitely a darker turn to events, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. And then, the last thing we covered was some of the X-Men going on a little jaunt to the Himalayas. That was kind of a nice little side story, like a one and done, if you like, if that's possible in this run that never seems to stop going.
That's right.
Yeah. And we've got another nice little story coming up today.
Yeah. Just to remind folks who maybe are tuning into us for the first time, we'll kind of do a Marvel thing. We will consider that this podcast is everyone's first, huh?
Okay, yeah.
And we'll remind folks that the X-Men The Hidden Years is John Byrne's take of continuing the X-Men as if it was issue 67 from the original. All the way, his intent was to lead up to the new X-Men joining in on Giant Size X-Men number one. And so these are kind of the in-between years, which is why it's called The Hidden Years. And it incorporates what he thinks or what he imagines stories between the X-Men 6 and when the new X-Men came in on Giant Size X-Men 91, or number one, and which would have been X-Men 94 as the first issue continuing in the series. Anything else you want to remind folks about what we're covering here, Nigel?
Not really, other than just an immediate reminder of where we were last time. Because as I just mentioned on one of the last episodes that we looked at, the X-Men went to the Himalayas on a little mission. When they returned back to the Xavier's mansion, of course, they were met by Kraven the Hunter, who had stolen into the mansion and was waiting for them, which is where we're going to carry on today. So just to remind anybody who may have forgotten from last time, that's where we were.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's with issue 17, which
and that's issue 17.
For, correct?
That's right. Yeah.
All right. So, off we go.
I'll get into that. Yeah.
Thank you. Awesome.
So first one, X-Men: The Hidden Years, number 17, with a cover date of April 2001. Release date was the 7th of February 2001. 32 pages. 22 pages of story. And the production team, writer and penciler John Byrne, the inker Tom Palmer, colorist Gregory Wright, the letterer was John Byrne. Editor for this issue is Lisa Hawkins, and the editor-in-chief is Joe Quesada. Now, I had a look to see what else Byrne might have been doing for an April 2001 release, and it doesn't look like he was very busy at all. The only thing I could find for this month was Incredible Hulk trade paperback titled Transformations, which itself, I believe, is a re-release of the original publication of the same thing from 1995. And I assume that it's got one or maybe more stories in it, which Byrne has written or drawn or both. So some of the content of it is by John Byrne, which is why it's listed. Other than that, and this issue that I'm about to cover, that was it for April 2001.
It definitely seems like a very slow month.
I was going to say, he's definitely... He's definitely not working too hard at the moment, as it were.
Considering just a few years, or in the 80s, 70s and 80s, doing four or five stories, full books, or partial stories or whatever. And even in this era, earlier in the run, he'd been doing one or two other books a month. So interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So, right, before I get into the synopsis, though, I just wanted to mention something. I was thinking about, as you said earlier, the issues of the original X-Men from issue 67 up to when the new X-Men came in with Giant Size. They were just reprints of the X-Men stories that had already gone before. So I thought, this issue 17, I looked at the corresponding issue of what it would have been and when it would have come out, and tried to link it to the past, as it were, at that time, which would have been, it was round about, 1973, and wondered perhaps if there was any strong connection with regard to Kraven, as in where he might have appeared just before.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I didn't find a lot. I didn't find anything definite, anything concrete to say, he last appeared here and that brought him to the event, to the X-Men's mansion. There's no absolute connection like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The nearest thing I could trace it to, and it's like about a year before that, he appeared in Amazing Spider-Man 110 and 111, although it was like the antagonist in the background on that one. It's the one with the gibbon. I don't know whether you remember that.
Slightly.
It was the first appearance of the gibbon, but he uses the gibbon, basically, against Spider-Man. So he's like in the background. He doesn't actually attack Spider-Man himself on this occasion. But of course, as we know, Spidey sort of helps the gibbon to escape from his clutches. And then he appeared in Daredevil 104. That was the closest connection I could make. Yeah. But as I said, that was in the year before the original story that corresponds with this issue.
Okay.
So there's no really close link. But still, I liked the idea of bringing him in.
At that era, he could have showed up for any reason in any book.
Yes.
That was what the era dictated.
So
no rhyme or reason to why a character would go from one book to another. It was like, we need a new threat. Let's just pull Kraven over,
That's right. And something a bit different, maybe.
Yeah.
And I think actually Byrne had a kind of soft spot for Kraven, because he uses him in one or two places in other books, or he had used him, should I say. Yeah, he seems to like Kraven, even though a lot of people think that Kraven's a bit of a meh villain. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
Well, he doesn't look very meh on this cover by Byrne.
No, he doesn't, no. Well, I was just going to say, Byrne has this skill, though, for taking these kind of villains that everybody sort of looks at and thinks, they're a bit useless. And he makes them dangerous.
Wasn't Kraven the villain in the Tigress Spider-Man team-up? I can't remember off the top of my head. Yeah.
Issue 67, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think we'll cover that on the regular Third Degree Burn series at some point. So stay tuned.
If we haven't already done so. May have covered it at some time already.
Yeah,
right, I'll get into this synopsis, and the title of this story is called Hunter and Hunted. And as I said, just to remind you where it starts, Kraven the Hunter has come to Xavier's school for gifted youngsters, and he wants to challenge the Beast. The story opens as such. The Beast moves warily through the trees on the Westchester estate grounds. He feels the eyes of the Hunter upon him, waiting to strike. But he is determined to give Kraven the hunt of his career. Inside the mansion, the X-Men await the outcome of the duel. They check on the condition of Avia, who Kraven has poisoned. Iceman recalls that Kraven has promised to give the antidote for Avia to the X-Men after the hunt is over, whether Beast wins or loses the challenge. Beast, meanwhile, questions if Kraven is quite the noble hunter he makes himself out to be, as he neglected to mention that he has prepared some traps before the X-Men returned from their last mission in the Himalayas. Beast has already narrowly avoided pit traps and snares, and as he swings through the trees, Beast is suddenly caught in a spring-loaded net. Meanwhile, in an undisclosed hideout, Tad Carter talks to other members of the group named The Promise. Tad urges to bring Lorna Dane into the group, but their leader, Tobias Messenger, tells Tad he must be patient. Back at the mansion, Cyclops makes plans to ensure Hank is safe, even if they cannot help him directly, as per Craven's terms. Lorna seems distracted. She hears someone call her name, but it's not any of the X-Men. Back outside, Beast frees himself from the net trap, unaware that he is slowly being weakened by venoms on the traps. Now Craven makes his move to hunt his prey. Switch to Dunphy, Illinois. FBI agent Fred Duncan visits Professor X to talk about the incident involving the Sentinel. See previous issues. Duncan can't hide the fact that he notices romantic tension between Xavier and Terry Martin, Ashley's mother. In the gardens of Xavier's mansion, Cyclops, Marvel Girl, Havoc, Lorna and Iceman search for Beast's whereabouts. The tension between Iceman and Havoc continues, and Cyclops shows his dismay about Bobby's lack of discipline. And in addition, it seems Lorna is now very distracted all the time. Elsewhere, Craven steals up behind the Beast, and seeing the X-Man's uncertainty, he attacks. The two get into a battle, both physically and verbally. Meanwhile, Havoc searches for Lorna, who's wandered off just as Marvel Girl detects Beast's exact position. But she's worried as his thought patterns seem out of focus. Suddenly, the Beast's attacks on Craven become more vicious, and Craven is overwhelmed. The poisons in Hank's system have sent him into a frenetic rage, and he nearly kills Craven during the final showdown, but he's stopped by Cyclops' optic blast. Later, back at the mansion, Craven gives the X-Men the antidote for Avia. They decide they must let Craven go, but Marvel Girl wipes out his memory of the X-Men and his battle with the Beast first. Hank is upset, as he always feared he had a darker side in him, but Scott and Jean assure him that his behaviour was not his fault. Finally, Havoc bursts in and informs his teammates that Lorna Dane is gone. He tells them she floated up into the air and just drifted away. To be continued. Next, what is The Promise? Denim.
There we go.
So yes, that was... I liked this issue. Yeah. I'm glad you asked me to cover this one. It's one of my favorites, actually. Yeah.
I think it's one of the best of the series, actually, in my opinion. And I like that one too.
Was starting with the cover, yeah, as you mentioned too earlier. It's a great picture with like Beast there in the foreground.
This is really a fantastic cover.
Yeah.
This truly is probably one of the best covers of the series as well. It's so totally, to me, a Marvel cover, what made Marvel covers so good. I can't particularly say that it fits with that era, because that's when we had like the borders and the a lot of weird designs on those covers. But man, this is really a good cover.
Yeah, true. Yeah. And I like the way, yeah, let's say they've got Craven really lurking through the tree there behind the Beast. He's sneaking up on him, looking very sinister. And I like the way he's like, he's in the way of the title. He covers up part of the X-Men The Hidden Years headline.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So making like a 3D effect, if you like.
Yeah, which back in the day wouldn't yeah. have happened, because...
Yeah, that'd have been a bit of a no-no, yeah, to cover up the title. No-no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, do you know why that they wouldn't let the titles get covered up like that?
Well, only I don't know if there's any special reason other than just because it would affect, people might miss it if it can't read the title fully. But well, is there another reason?
I think there is. And yeah. I think I read this, and I could be fact checked, and that's okay. But because back in the X-Men 50s, there was one where the X-Men were supposed to be displayed across the top of the
yeah.
the word X-Men, but they said no, because that was going to obscure the title. Because back in those days, most comics were on a spinner rack. So they were about five high, and the metal rack would spin around. And so basically all you would see would be the title on the top of the cover, unless it was the bottom. The bottom rack, you got to see the full cover of the book. But as the books progressed up the rack, all you could see was the title. So they wanted to have the title clearly visible in the front so that you could see what the book was as it was displayed on the rack. And having visited those spinner racks, basically what would we do is we would put our hand, because they would have like six or eight books in one little holder there, and we would pull them down and just kind of let them flip back so you could rifle them all and see. So books got destroyed. I mean, they were bent on the spine,
bent over, and
turned over. But that's how you would see what book you wanted. You would kind of like pull the whole stack forward, and then just let your fingers pull forward until the book would flop back. And then all you would see would be about the top quarter of the title of the book. So you had to have the title specifically clear so that you knew what the title was and what book you wanted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see.
In modern days, they're displayed on shelves, all laid out across. They're pretty much not covered up.
Yeah,
like you were back on the spinner racks.
Mm. So easy to see. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, great cover. And yeah,
this is a fantastic cover.
Mm, yeah, I like that. And did you find the hidden number for this issue?
Yes, I think I did anyway. Right. Well, actually, I found what I thought were two.
You always find these other numbers, don't you?
Yeah. Before I point out the one where I think is the correct one, the one that I first found was above left eye, and it kind of looks like a heart on the trunk of the tree. And if you turn it to the left, the heart kind of turns into an eight, and it almost looks like there's a three there, because I was looking for 83.
Mm.
So if you rotate the book to the left and look at it there, to me, it looks like it could be an 83 or an 85, but I don't think we're looking for issue 85. I found the number actually to the left of his left eye on the branch that to me clearly looks like an 83.
Yeah, I was going to say you were getting me a bit worried there. I thought you were going to go to some other part of the picture for your other one. And I thought, well, no, that's it. That's the one the one you were talking about is the one. But yeah,
but now I see. Yeah,
I've just done what you said now, and I see it like an 85. Yeah, but yeah. No, this is the one, I think, just to Beast's left.
Yeah, to the right as we're looking at it.
Yes, yeah, to the right as we're looking at it, just above that like dark hole in the trunk. Yep. Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, yeah.
It was a little bit hard because it's a little. When there's so much detail and it's a little bit dark, it makes it a little bit harder. Mm, but it kind of popped in.
Yeah, there's all sorts of squiggles around, isn't there? Because if you look at that tree in the background, just above Beast's like left eyebrow, there's like a heart shape, isn't there?
Yeah, well, that's the
drawn a heart.
That's the one I thought was the
right.
First
yeah.
Oh, yeah. I was like, okay. So he's got some little distractions there.
Oh, definitely, yeah. But yeah, that's the one. And, of course, that's the one I was talking about before. The corresponding X-Men 83,
yeah.
That was the one that was had the cover date of August 1973.
When you did that, did you put it as a bi-monthly or a monthly book?
They were bi-monthly at the time, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. Yeah.
So that were another thing. When I was trying to trace where Craven might have appeared last, I thought, oh, this is going to be awkward, because although that relates to this issue, number 17 is 83, they were bi-monthly at the time.
Yeah,
but it didn't really make much difference because, yeah, as I say, I couldn't find anything any closer where Craven appeared. Daredevil was the closest.
And for a new listener who may not say, what are you talking about? What John Byrne did was is he hid some Easter eggs, and he continued, although X-Men Hidden Years has its own unique numbering system, he sort of continued these issues as if they had continued on in production. So issue 17 would have been issue 83 had they not gone into.
That's right.
Yeah. So
Yeah.
Okay. Here we go.
And so, yes, so the cover, yes, we're very much, we like that. And then the splash page.
A pinup, basically. This is like the old school Marvel pinups that we used to get in the 70s, that we like in the king size special editions or king size annuals. When they were filling up some blank pages, they would give us these cool pinups. I never tore mine out, but boy, did I want to, because I love pinups. Yeah. And this is a total pinup. Man, is it a great splash page.
Yeah, it is like that. Yeah, it gives you that impression. Perhaps a little bit more, shall we say, of a full background than a lot of those old pinups.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But yeah, it's still a pinup pose. Yeah, it's a good, nice picture.
As the White Widow in the Avengers movie would say to Black Widow, you're such a poser.
Yeah.
You're a poser. Well, no, it's a great image, really.
And of course, it starts where he's already into the hunt, which was suggested at the end of the previous issue.
Yeah,
swinging through the trees, looking for or trying to avoid Kraven wherever he is. Yeah,
yeah, great start off, and then and then we get some background with we flash back to the rest of the story. You know, the background of it to get it started. Now, what do you think about when we get into a book like this where we kind of start in the story and then we have to flashback? Should we just start at the beginning? Or what do you think about doing it in that format? Because Byrne does that a lot.
Yes, he likes to do that. And it's different. It might take a bit of getting used to, I guess, for some people, but it works. But it must be confusing. It's more confusing for people who are maybe just jumping on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're following it month by month, as it were, and you're getting the issues on a regular basis, you know what's happened before. So even if the first page sort of takes you by surprise because you think, oh, I was expecting to see such and such, and this is not it. you know, they leave it on a cliffhanger.
Yeah, definitely.
And then with a lot of the older comics, like back in the 70s, that's where they would start the next issue with the same cliffhanger situation, but from a different angle or perspective. Mm-hmm. You were basically where you were when you left off. And like, but Byrne never does that. Yeah. You end on a cliffhanger and then you open up the next issue, and for the first two or three pages or more sometimes, it's not about where it left off, and you think, you know, gets you a bit panicky for a bit. You think, what's what's that? Have I missed an issue?
Have I missed something? Exactly. Yeah.
And then, of course, you get to about page 3 or 5, and there it is. You're back where it left off with the big situation, the cliffhanger situation. I like it, yeah. But as I say, it might take some getting used to, and it might be a bit more confusing for people who have just started to read the title.
I thought it was interesting. I loved how, because I was a Spider-Man collector in the 70s as a kid. So Kraven would pop up now and other adjacent books. I don't really recall him in anything else than Spider-Man, but it could have been. But
It was in the 60s. He popped up once or twice in other books.
Yeah,
but not so much in the 70s until we get towards the end of the 70s.
Yeah,
I mean, early in. Sorry,
but what I was thinking is that I really liked how Byrne kind of tapped into Kraven's character. He really is about the hunt. I don't know if I would really consider him a villain per se. Not like the kind that are like holding the pinky against the mouth and saying, I want $1 million.
Yes.
Type of thing, you know.
Yeah.
Really was about the challenge and the hunt. And I think Byrne really kind of kept that. Because at first I was like, why the heck would Kraven even care about the X-Men or even know about them, for one thing? But that's a backstory for somehow. But it was really about, I want the challenge. I want the beast looks like a challenge and I'm going to go for it.
Yeah.
So I felt like he kind of kept that characterization.
Yeah. And it's his, and it's about his honor. Yeah. Although, as it went along, they started to sort of show that Kraven is not such an honorable hunter.
Yes,
he's a cheat.
Yes, he is. Yeah.
Yeah. Because he sort of sets things up in advance, you know, like these traps and everything. So he's not exactly playing fair with his challenges.
Yeah, definitely so.
He's rigging the deck, as it were. Yeah, it's a bit of a flashback, as you say here, where he's saying he poisoned Avia, and he'll give them the antidote, though, so whatever the outcome of the challenge is.
Yep.
But Beast doesn't really trust him that much.
Nope.
Because, he's discovered these few traps already.
When we get to the page with the traps, boy, does it look like those three panels look so much like a Danger Room session. So
yes,
I would be thinking, boy, B should be really happy he went through all those Danger Room sessions with Professor X and the team.
Mm. Yeah, but this is more dangerous because the spikes at the bottom of the pit and things like
that. For real.
Yeah, for real.
They're not a hollow deck.
Yeah. And the artwork, it's really Neil Adamsy, I think, that page.
That's it is, really, And I think it helps with Tom Palmer.
Yes.
The art, an anchor back, kind of helping to make that happen. Mm-hmm. Very good stuff.
And then Beast falls for the trap, even gets caught in a net. And then we switch to a completely different scene.
Now we're getting into this group.
We meet the Promise.
Did they call him the Promise here, or do we find that out later? Doesn't matter.
Maybe they didn't actually say it on the page, but that's who they are.
That's who they are. Is this a good time to talk about what do you think of them, or shall we wait until we get a little further into the story about who they are?
Like next issue, but let's save that for your issue. We've got this strange. Well, they're not strange at this stage. They're just a group of what look like mainly ordinary people.
Yeah, we don't know them really.
They're obviously talking about, they've got some kind of an agenda, obviously. But we don't know any more about them other than Tad Carter, who we've already met when he kind of like had an afternoon with Lorna.
A little afternoon delight.
And he seemed to be persuading her to make decisions that she wouldn't have normally made. So there's perhaps some kind of special power there, but we don't know much about the rest of them.
Just a little quick interlude here, which led us into Lorna being distracted and kind of thinking about some other things.
Mm-hmm. And then she hears her name mentioned,
Yeah, kind of interesting.
Somebody says Lorna, but it's none of the X-Men. It's none of the people that she's with. So it's like, oh, right.
Yeah. Now, I guess that's probably pretty strong that Jean didn't notice it. As a telepath, so
at that moment, though, Jean's fixed on trying to tune into the Beast.
That's true. Yeah.
So maybe
it's a little bit hard. And then next page, we find the Beast is able to make short work of that net. Didn't keep him down for long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Craven's looking at his cell phone.
Just watching. That's what it looks like.
Just checking on Beast's physical condition there to make sure he's now sufficiently pumped with venom, so it's time to start hunting. Yeah, and then a quick interlude with Professor X back in Illinois.
And as you mentioned, kind of noticing a little romantic tension here, interest.
Yeah. So, but I think it's more at the moment. I mean, she seems to be falling for Professor X.
It kind of does, yeah.
He's just enjoying the situation.
Well, then we get into that battle between Havoc and Iceman. Yeah, carrying this over is definitely part of what was happening, because those tensions were definitely set up in the original series by Roy Thomas and crew.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bobby had his heart set on Lorna, and she's like, you're a nice kid, but I kind of like an older boy named Havoc. So.
And so he's...
He was a little disappointed at that, for sure.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And in true Bobby form, I mean, Bobby was a hothead, he was kind of immature, and this is totally in line with his character at the time.
True. Mm-hmm. And then Lorna's still,
a little bit, very much distracted, as you saw.
They're talking to her, you're distracted. She's looking all over the place, wondering about.
Then we get 3.5 pages of really good action.
Yes, this is the battle between Hank and Craven. But I like, as I said in the synopsis, it's not only a good physical battle, they kind of like dueling with words as well. And there's some really good stuff coming out, especially from the Beast. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. With the way he speaks anyway, using the highfalutin words and everything.
Yeah. And it's really kind of cool because it's kind of leading into the blue furry beast. I think we're kind of seeing a little bit of that from the Avengers. I mean, he wasn't as scientific when he had changed into the Beast.
Mm.
And he was a little bit more happy-go-lucky, kind of joking, but he was still the scientist, and he was still... And I think this is kind of transitioning him from the original series, where he was really more about the scientific stuff, and we're seeing a lot more of the playfulness of the character that underlined the blue furry beast that we saw in Avengers.
Yeah.
Mm. That's what I'm kind of seeing
here. Yeah, yeah.
I kind of like that, because it's not... When you have this, it's not so much of a drastic change. Like, what? Who is this Beast person? After Amazing Adventures 11, who is this? This is not Hank McCoy that we saw in X-Men. So this kind of like makes shows a transition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, showing that that part of him was, it was always in him even before he became a furry beast.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. And then I like that, you see at the bottom of the page where he... Craven does the nerve pinch with he hits him at the back of the neck with his elbow.
Yeah.
And he goes his arm goes numb. And then he says, a certifiably Spock-like maneuver, Craven. Mister, not doctor.
Yeah.
That's Byrne using his love of the Star Trek as well. Yeah. And then he says, it'll take more than a transitory torpor of a single extremity to abridge the bellicosity of the most exuberant of the X-Men. Wow.
That was great. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he says, I'm sure, I can depend on your affirmation. And Craven just says, you chatter like a tree full of baboons. Is it your greatest gift to bore your enemies to death? Yeah. But it's funny, right? Because that line that Craven says there about you chatter like a tree full of baboons, it reminds me of an episode of Blackadder. I don't know whether have you seen Blackadder, the comedy?
Not really. Little bits and pieces, I think, but not.
With Rowan Atkinson. Oh, yeah. Okay. I think it was in the second series with the when they were in the Elizabethan era, and Melchett's saying to him, whenever he asks Blackadder a question, he never answers him truthfully or straight. He always kind of wraps his answer up in a riddle, or he doesn't say the truth. And he said something to that effect. He says, you never answer me straight. You twist and turn like a, and then he pauses and then he says, like a twisty turny thing. Because he can't think of anything else to say. And it just reminds me of that when it says, you chatter like a tree full of baboons. And then then Craven's like, he frees himself from Beast's trap there. And then Havoc's looking for Lorna. She's disappeared altogether.
Yeah, yeah. We don't even get to see her floating away.
We see, he looks up and he can see something, but we can't see it.
Yeah, we just have to assume what it is.
Mm.
Yeah. Interlude over.
Back to Marvel Girls just honed in on the Beast.
Yeah. Great panel at the bottom.
Yes.
Again, which is the cover, basically,
mm-hmm.
seconds later or something.
Yeah.
Two seconds later. Good stuff there. I like that. That's kind of ties in like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And then more action, more pages of action. This is really just a great action-filled cover.
Mm.
Issue. Take out the couple of pages of the plot lines for the future, but... Mm-hmm. We really got some good stuff here.
Yeah, it's I like to see that, because in a lot of the more modern comics, I don't know whether it's just me or what, but whenever you get like two combatants, if you like, having a fight, it doesn't seem to last very long. And I remember, though, like back in the older comics of the 60s and early 70s, you did get battles like this that went on for pages and pages.
Mm-hmm.
This reminds me of those kind of conflicts, you know.
Yeah.
Evenly matched, and they're both giving each other as good as they get.
Yeah, until Hank starts losing, yeah, giving in to the base desire. And here again, we see some of that beast nature there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I see there at the bottom of the next page, Byrne has not forgotten about Craven's jacket top, that he's got this built-in sort of some sort of power beam that comes out of the lion's eyes.
I always thought those eyes were kind of strange.
Yeah.
They had a purpose. Like, I don't ever remember seeing this feature of the costume before. I don't know if this is new or not.
It's not. No, he started using it in Spider-Man. It'd be roundabout. Let me see. I'm probably going to get this wrong. But with regard to when he first used it, maybe in Spider-Man, something like 47, 48, something like that. Yeah, he's had that for quite a while.
You know what it reminds me of? And this is, it reminds me of two instances in film. The one being a Peter Sellers Pink Panther film. I think it was Revenge of the Pink Panther.
Right.
And Inspector Clouseau. Yeah. Was at a German Oktoberfest. And of course, the spies were trying to kill Clouseau. And this woman, this German woman who was serving beers and stuff, she turned around, and a very healthily endowed woman. And she was going to kill Inspector Clouseau. And all of a sudden, you see these two little knives pop out of her breast. And she went to hug him, and she was going to kill him that way.
Yeah.
Well, he had this giant pretzel. She hugged him, and she walked away. It didn't work because the pretzel got in the way. She walked away.
She got the pretzel.
And the other one was in the Mike Myers film with the fembots, and they had the breast turned into the little shotguns.
All right. Yeah.
In that. And so that just kind of reminds me of that.
Yeah.
Oddly enough. So I'm sorry for that trip down those lanes.
Similar setup, with regard to.
Austin Powers.
Yeah. That's it. Film.
Yeah. So crazy, crazy stuff.
Yeah. And then Beasts, as you say, he's become a bit wild, and even those rays are not going to stop him.
Nope.
And he gets hold of him, gets hold of him by the leg and swings.
Gone dark beast on us here.
Yeah, swings him round like a rag doll and then starts beating him up.
And then of course, he's like, "I, because I'm a cheater, I really don't want to get into this. Stop, heal, uncle, stop.
Yeah.
Help me."
Yeah, okay, you win. And then, of course, Cyclops to the rescue.
Yeah.
Blasts Beast back so that he doesn't kill Craven.
And then a pretty quick wrap-up because...
That's the end of the confrontation. And it's,
we're out of pages here.
Back at the mansion now, and what are they going to do with Craven,
And now, it's kind of odd. Because that Byrne talks about Marvel Girl, wiping his memories, and it's happened a lot, it seems, or a few times.
Mm.
And I remember in X-Men 131, after the confrontation with the White Queen and the Hellfire Club, and we had the introduction of Dazzler, at the end of that issue, when things were calming, Kitty Pryde's parents came out, and they were all freaked out and upset because she disappeared, and the malt shop had been blown up, and the bodies examined, and Kitty was nowhere, and they were just furious. And then Jean altered their memory and changed what they were doing. And Scott said at the time, he's like, "Jean, why did you do that? That's something that you were really against doing." But here she does it like, "Oh, no problem." So it's slightly, to me, it seems like a little, knowing the history of these characters, a little out of character. But, it seems a little beyond them. And Professor X been shown here to alter memories a lot.
Doing that,
frequently as well. So,
I mean, unless it's because it depends on the situation. Because, like here, if they don't wipe Craven's memory, then he now knows where the X-Men's hidden base is, if you like.
Well, I understand
which,
that.
Which could come back to haunt them. I mean, he might not say anything, but he might tell somebody else, "Hey, if you want to attack the X-Men, I know where they live," kind of thing. Maybe Scott's okay with that in this particular situation.
I get it, but...
Whereas Kitty's parents, I mean, they've not been involved in any of the fighting, and they're not the bad guys. So it's easier to just, yeah, let them forget about what happened to cover their secrets again.
It still seems contradictory to me.
Yeah, well, it
based
is.
Based on
yeah.
what was established up until then. But that's okay. Mm-hmm. I'm not it's just slightly not.
I'm just looking. I'm looking for a no prize, but
yeah, no, good stuff. And then, of course, we end the issue with Alex coming in, trying.
That's right.
Panicked about Lorna disappearing.
Mm-hmm. She's gone. She's floated up and drifted away. And that's it. But yeah, a really good issue. It's kind of a dunning one, but yeah, it's not. Because the other subplots are just taking it on its merry way.
Right. You know, you had to kind of, that was the style. I mean, if this had really been 1973, none of those other little subplots would have been that much prevalent, I think. We would have just got the next issue talking about them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, good stuff. Totally a good issue. I loved it. All right, shall we move on to the next one?
Yeah, let's have a look at issue number 18.
So the cover, this is X-Men Hidden Years 18. Cover is by John Byrne. Cover date of May 2001 with a price of a whopping $2.50 US, $3.75 Canadian. I don't know what it would have been in England at the time.
No, I've got a direct edition here, so it's only got the US and Canada prices on it the same. So yeah. I don't know. I can't remember what I would have been paying. Well, if it's $2.50,
probably would have been wrong.
Probably paying about $1.25 or something like that.
The release date is March 14th, 2001, and it had 32 pages. Yeah. I didn't count up how many stories on.
It's usually 22.
Yeah. So very good. The listed as writer, artist, John Byrne and Tom Palmer. So they didn't break him out as penciler and inkers in the front page of this. We're just assuming Tom is the inker and the finisher. Right?
Yeah.
Colorist is Greg Wright. The letterer is not listed. I guess we're assuming it's John Byrne. Associate editor is Lisa Hawkins. Editor is Joe Casava, editor-in-chief.
Mm.
The story title is Promise a New Tomorrow. So here's the synopsis. Angel is about to return to Xavier's School for Gifted Youngsters when he spots Lorna Dane drifting through the air. As Warren decides to follow her, the other X-Men discuss Lorna's appearance, continued from the last. And Iceman is quite angry that Havoc did nothing to stop this, but without being able to fly, there's not much Havoc could have done to help Lorna. A little later, Lorna finds herself in a dark room and is greeted by Tad Carter, who introduces her to the group named The Promise. The leader is Tobias Messenger, who is a telepath like Charles Xavier, but can only communicate via telepathy because he is mute. As the X-Men arrive outside at the Angel's location, they find a portal that can't be entered and are greeted by a large monster. Kind of reminiscent. Yeah, say that later. Switch to Dunphy, Illinois. Professor X and Terry Martin have another private conversation. Xavier senses that Terry is wishing her daughter would not have experienced the incident with the Sentinel and all subsequent official investigation. Terry agrees, but she does not regret Charles. Ooh. Messenger from The Promise explains that the initial group of mutants formed by a would-be world conqueror named The Claw, but The Claw's plans fail, and Messenger took over the group, giving them a different purpose. Cut to more monsters showing up and attacking the X-Men. Turns out the monsters were illusion, covering the actual X-Men, and thus the X-Men take each other out one by one. Gracie Smith, another telepath, who is part of The Promise, was responsible for the illusion, and now the group members argue about what to do with X-Men. Havoc is as a potential recruit like Lorna. Back inside, the conversation continues between Lorna and Messenger. The Promise expects a war between mutants and humans, and they put themselves in suspended animations for interviews of 10 years. When they wake up, like at this point, they observe the current political situation and necessary act as the voice of reason, quote-unquote, among the mutant community. But they also continue to recruit new members, and Lorna Dane is their new conquest. I mean, their new candidate, because she is not yet indoctrinated by either Professor X or Magneto. Mm-hmm. issue ends with a shocking revelation. The Promise intends to place Lorna, Angel, and Havoc and the expanded animation them asleep until the dawn of the next century, when the group believes their leadership will be needed to rebuild the world. A cover which to me seems pretty much like a cover that would have fit in that era, aside from some of the title dress, and some of those covers had big block spaces on the side and a small block on the inside. But yeah, the team in the middle surrounded by shadowy figures around so that we don't know who they are, that pretty much is a what I think would be a Marvel cover of the year, of the era. What do you think, Nigel?
Yes, yeah. Although maybe, I don't know whether, he's got the, as you say, he's got the characters of the Promise are all just like silhouettes.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think that maybe if this was a cover of the period, we'd probably see them as well.
Mm.
This showing people in silhouette seemed sort of came in later, I think. Okay. And it's also something Byrne likes to do.
Yeah. Yeah, as, he wants that mystery to draw you in.
Yeah, as we've seen with several Alpha Flight covers, for example.
Yeah,
definitely. He uses the silhouette effect.
Yes, he does. Yeah.
So, yeah. And apart from that, it probably is
editor,
the type. Yeah.
Editor's note here, like the old-fashioned stuff. See the coverage of Alpha Flight on Third Degree Burn that Nigel was part of. Little cross promotion there.
Yes.
Yep. All right. Did you find the issue number?
Yes.
Was it easy for you this time?
Yeah, it slaps you in the face, really.
It kind of does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
under
Bobby's armpit.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah. There it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no problem with that one.
Yeah, that was pretty clear.
84, yeah.
That's okay. We need a few softballs now and then after some of the harder ones he gave us earlier on.
Yeah.
Some of those were quite difficult. And three, right, that you still are not quite certain of?
No, I'm actually down to only one now that I'm not certain of.
Okay.
The others I know, or I know where they should have been.
Yeah.
Some of them had actually been cut off, apparently. So we had no chance of finding them because
we
couldn't see them. Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, there's only one that I'm really not 100% on now.
Is it coming up or have we already?
Oh, no, it's way back. It's about, it was about the seventh issue or something like that.
Yeah.
It was the one when, you know, when they're in the, they just escaped from the Savage Land.
Okay.
And they were in Africa, the one with the guy called Delu. And the one where he's on the cover. I'm still not totally convinced that the number I found is the actual number, but I can't find anything to prove otherwise. So, yeah.
Well, dear listeners, if you can find a number on that issue, please write in and tell us where you think it is. Let's see if we can coordinate our efforts. That'd be great.
Yeah.
And do you want to tell what issue is it? Do you remember what issue number we're looking for?
I think it was 73.
It's okay.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
All right, dear listeners, fill us in. Help us, please. That'd be great. All right, let's get into the issue. We are here, The Promise of a New Tomorrow, on the splash page.
Yeah, splash page. Nice. Different.
Very different.
Look at when you first open it up, though, I thought, oh, the moon. It took me a while to sort of focus in on the silhouette figure of the angel, and then I thought, but I still wasn't sure. Even then I thought, okay, it's the angel, but is he in space?
Yeah,
because he could be on just looking at this picture.
Yeah, or either that or we have a crossover with the Legion of Superheroes.
Yeah, we have someone else who's got wings or something who can go into space. Yeah,
that would be Dawnstar. Yes,
right. Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, but then the next page it's clear that it's Angel.
Yeah, he's just flying at night.
Now, I did a little kind of a look. I was doing some, pulling some information, and it said that this is the first time showing Lorna can fly.
Right.
So, interesting, yeah.
Well, she couldn't fly, could she, before? That's what they suggest.
She quote unquote flies by manipulating the magnetic.
Yeah.
So, I think this probably is, I don't know that we've seen it before. I don't even know if we've seen it before in the original series at this point.
Mm.
I can't recall, but
Yeah, I don't recall her flying at all. But
so we got the current scene. Angel finds her, and then again we're back to Bobby and Havoc arguing and fighting.
Yeah,
these two, I would have thought that mind blast in the last issue would have fixed them, but no, they still got to keep going. These two just really don't like each other.
No.
For obvious reasons. I think Havoc's indifferent to Bobby. Bobby's just being a hothead, 17-year-old or whatever, and Havoc's just like, go away, little boy, you bother me.
Yeah.
I can't stand.
Mind you, is he that much older than Iceman?
It's really hard to tell.
Because Havoc's supposedly, he's the younger brother of Scott.
Yeah.
So, and Scott wouldn't be that old at this time, would he?
It's hard to tell. Maybe 1920.
Yeah, I'm going to say, if Scott's 20, 21, that's about as much as he would be. And then Havoc's younger than him.
So he'd be about 19 or so.
He'd be 19, say, yeah. So there's only a couple of years in it. But yeah. I suppose at that stage of life, it probably means more.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Bobby's not very emotionally mature.
No.
He might be 17, but he's still acting like a 14 at some time.
Yeah.
So, well, there we go. And then we flip over and we get back to the present where Angel has landed. And what is that thing he's standing next to? I haven't seen one of those.
It's a phone box. But it's not a box. Well, it is a box, but it's not a phone box like a British phone box.
No. Yeah, it's a payphone area.
Yeah.
I wonder where he had his coins. I mean, I don't think that costume has any pockets or a pouch or something. This isn't the 90s when they had pouches.
Hey, you'd be surprised, though, where they used to keep things in skin-tight uniforms when they needed to. Yeah.
Definitely so. Well,
he could have had it in his boot.
Well, there you go. Yeah,
it might be a bit uncomfortable, though.
Well, when I was a kid, I used to keep a dime in my shoe for the bus or the or a phone call. Oh, there we go. Yeah, and Lorna kind of quote unquote wakes up in a dark room, and there's
Tad.
There's Tad. Yeah, and then she gets to meet everybody, and now they kind of. Now they're uniformed. They're little jackets and they're beige, kind of like a uniform. Yeah. Last time we saw them, they were all in regular street clothes. So
mm-hmm. Kind of interesting. Now they're in an outfit that.
So here we are kind of getting an introduction. And then real quick, we're back to the X-Men following.
They're meeting up with the Angel following his telephone call because he's found where Lorna went to.
There we go. That airplane, that Blackbird, boy, that thing, they're really lucky they found lots of places where they could just land that in.
Yeah, they always seem to find a landing area.
Yeah, and it's definitely not quiet. Those engines on there are kind of like probably like VTOL helicarriers. And
they're going to be screaming.
Yeah,
to
you know
extent.
It.
Definitely
no subtlety there. No element of surprise on that.
It's going to be like something like out of Star Wars.
Definitely. So we have this really cool looking house, and there's some sort of a weird.
It's kind of it's sort of a cross between a house and a, I don't know, office block, but in its own grounds. Yeah, with a spider-like gate.
And then I like how they're like, whoa, you idiot, why didn't you just go in after her? And I like how Warren's like, be my guest. Go ahead, try it. So there we go. Taught you. And then, of course, the monster arrived. And here we are. To me, this kind of really reminded me of FF number one.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You know, the monster arriving out of the ground with the Fantastic Four. It's not an exact replica of the cover, but it's kind of reminiscent of the cover.
Yeah.
I don't know if he intended it, but just that really cool monster coming out. And then the X-Men below, like, oh my gosh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then
I was wondering at that time, was this one of the actual members of the Promise who could turn into a monster?
Yeah.
That's like, what I thought at first.
Like Sasquatch or something, huh?
Yeah.
And back to Illinois, half a continent away. Charles and Terry talking again. You know, what do they do about Ashley? Some good stuff. Then we're back. We're back to the Promise, and we get a little bit more of the background story. We hear about the Claw. We find out this one lad is not a lad. He's been alive since 1945.
Yeah, this bit actually had me scrabbling back to look at the Marvel The Last Generation.
Oh, did it?
Okay. Yeah.
Because, were they part of that?
Well, that's what I was looking to see if I could find, because the Claw is in that story at some stage.
Yeah.
And I thought, so are some of these people from The Promise in there? I mean, I'd read it, but I couldn't remember fully because I was, you know, kind of taking in the story for the first time. But I knew that, oh, yeah, Yellowclaw was in the Lost Generation. So I went back and had a look, but no, you don't actually see any of these members of The Promise.
Okay. And he did, and John Byrne did do Lost Generation during part of the X-Men Hidden Years. So it wouldn't be...
That's why I thought they might appear, but I didn't see any of these particular characters.
Now, I know that another little side promotion, editor's note, I do believe that Brian wants us to cover the Lost Generation at some point. So... Mm. Dear listeners, have keep tuned. At some point, we'll probably be covered. I have never read Lost Generation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hadn't, but I read it last year.
I haven't had a chance to read it yet, and I'm wondering how it's going to turn. So
it's interesting.
Yeah, good.
It can be a bit confusing.
I'm sure, because you're going backwards
and forwards. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're explaining to Lorna what their basic gig is.
Yeah, what they plan to do and what they do.
How they want to accomplish things. And, you know, seems like an interesting thing, but then again, it seems kind of sinister in a way.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord. Okay. Not sure that I trust these guys.
Mm-hmm.
Folks, sometimes folks with quote unquote good intentions are sometimes the ones that will accomplish them at any cost, and that's not always good.
Yeah. And then the guy behind Tobias Messenger, he says he's been monitoring Craig's defense maneuvers against the X. Craig is obviously the person who's creating these. Well, at this stage, I thought, now, is Craig the monster?
Is he? Yeah, maybe so.
Or is he just making the illusions of the monsters?
Yeah, I think Gracie was the one who did the illusions.
Okay, so he could be that monster.
No? He probably is, yeah.
The big monster. But then when the others start to turn up, that's illusions of, yeah, she's making the other X-Men look like these creatures.
So we'll take them out.
Yeah, and then so they're knocking each other out.
The page after Jean and Scott are holding hands and we see that green monster, that kind of reminds me of Dire Wraiths from ROM.
Oh, right, yeah.
Just a slight bit. Not exactly, but it's kind of made me think of the Dire Wraiths from ROM.
Sees Scott as that creature. And
Scott sees Jean as that creature.
Yeah, and they've just took out Beast.
Yeah.
Because they saw him as another, like, horrible creature. Yeah, he sees Jean as that green thing.
Yeah.
With the spindly limbs and things.
And eventually they get them all taken out.
The Havoc takes out Scott.
Yeah.
Looking like some sort of, I don't know.
Electro.
Like an electro type creature. And then there's just Lorna and Havoc left.
That's it. Oh, you know what? Maybe.
Oh, and that wasn't Lorna, yeah.
Yeah, no, that was the girl.
That's her, yeah. Pretending
that guy is actually the illusion creator and she just drains stuff.
Possibly, yeah. She came in afterwards as Lorna and then. Yeah, she drains people's
energy or something.
Energy, or how much of him did you drain away, he says. Yeah.
Not much.
So a bit like Rogue maybe, but in a different way.
Yeah.
She doesn't touch them, though. She kind of kisses them. Mm.
Then we get back into the scene, and they're still talking with Lorna, explaining everything to her.
Yeah.
And, trying to convince her to join them willingly, I suppose. Well, they're going to keep her regardless, I think, This is that good intentions, quote unquote, but we're going to do things, whatever. It doesn't matter if you want to or not.
Yeah. But they sort of, they're trying to convince her that if it's left to the others, they'll just have a war between mutants and ordinary people. And
well, there we go. On this page, we found that Craig was the gentleman there and he did he was casting the illusion. So he didn't, right, he's not a shapeshifter, he just created the illusion.
He made the illusion.
So yeah, they decide they're going to keep them all. And the next thing we see is they're all getting ready to go back into suspended animation.
Yeah, they're all are they all hanging from something or on that picture at the top of that page where the X-Men are?
They seem to be floating,
but there's nothing holding them.
Yeah, they're kind of floating there. So someone must have...
Someone's got the ability to hold them. Yeah. Is it the blonde girl? The one who, like, she wants to keep the angel because she thinks he's beautiful.
I don't know. We haven't identified who has what kind of powers yet.
Mm.
So, yeah. So there we go. And now we're ready to probably the next issue will take us be full on this story.
They've talked Messenger into letting... They were going to keep Lorna, weren't they, on... And then they're going to keep Havoc, and she wants Angel. The other members of the group talk Messenger into letting her keep the Angel. Yeah. And then they're all put into these fancy cryogenic suits.
Yeah.
Yeah. And ready to be put under for until the next century. Which would be the 2000s. Yeah, so they'd be woken up now.
Woken up in our era.
Yeah.
So there we go. Wow, what do you think of this overall?
It's interesting because this is really, this is the first part where I can't really remember. I've only read most of them once until we started looking at it again. And from sort of here on, I don't remember exactly what happens. I'm aware of certain things, but I can't remember, the outcomes. So I really don't know what's going to happen exactly next.
Well, that's good. Then it'll be a surprise.
Yeah.
I know. Are you looking forward to this plot line? What do you think of this storyline, The Promised?
At this stage, I was kind of thinking, where are we going to go with this? I wasn't too sure whether I was going to find it that enjoyable or not.
Mm-hmm.
But then, I didn't know what he got in mind. So I was just, following along, waiting for the next thing.
And that's the thing. We don't need to know what he, we're not supposed to know what he has.
No.
Is it enough to entice you? Are you interested?
Yeah, I want to know where it's going to go, of course, because it seems like, you say they've pretty much got all of the X-Men in captivity.
Yeah, definitely.
I was probably thinking, so what are they going to do with the X-Men that they don't plan to keep?
I know, maybe just keep them on ice and... Wake them up in the new world once they've conquered or done whatever they're going to do, maybe. Who knows?
And like you said earlier, can we trust that they really mean to do what they say they mean to do, which seems like for the best, for the benefit of everybody, mutants and Homo sapiens.
Yeah.
Or does Messenger have some kind of hidden agenda?
Well, we'll tune in and find out.
We'll play it and see. Yeah.
19 and 20.
Yeah.
And we're getting close to the end of the run here.
We are. There's only another
four
issues to go.
Yeah. And we'll cover them all right here on Sideburns.
And maybe quite a bit still to be revealed. Yeah.
See?
Because
I don't remember how they turn out either. So I'm kind of going at this as if I hadn't read it before. Bits and pieces come back. I'm like, but I'm actually enjoying that it's almost like reading for the first time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that's what happens when you don't read something for 25 years. I can't believe it's been 25 years.
That's true, yeah.
Well, Nigel, anything else about these two issues?
Mm-hmm. Not really.
Okay.
I think we covered most of it,
I think we have.
I just like the usual thing that I say, but it's true. I mean, I really liked the artwork in this run. He was obviously looking and going for the Neil Adams kind of look and the style with the panels and everything. And that's probably one of the main reasons why Tom Palmer was chosen to be the inker to help give it that look, because he was the original inker on the Neil Adams issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I just... And even with that,
there's still the John Byrne-isms. His unique style, his storytelling style is still there. It's really great to see that he's able to merge the two to create this really great bridge between the original series and the new X-Men that came out. It's really a cool
imagining
of what could have been.
And some of the connections he makes to other titles as well that were running at that time is very well done.
Yes.
I mean, we've already seen one or two back around the time when there were still some of them in the Savage Land. Yes. Connections with FF and then Namor.
Yeah.
And when you look back at the original issues and you see the connection and you think, it did look like that, or that character did do that. So he's really linking it up well.
Yeah.
And he's not finished yet either. Remember that. There's more of there's one or two connections still to come.
Yeah. I don't think we see this, but I sure would like to have seen a Sutra of Daptoid or a Mimic Vision appearance.
Right.
Would have been fun.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, good. Well, Nigel, thanks so much. Are you going to take us out?
Where can people get in touch with us? We always usually give them the roundup.
We're on Facebook.
Facebook's
probably the best.
Yeah.
We don't have any other type of social, so Facebook is it, really. I think you can email, but I don't know if people are emailing as much anymore.
I don't think they are, but if you want to email, it's gottagetburn@gmail.com.
Facebook is Third Degree Burn with the numeral 3. 3 are find us there. Comment. Tell us what you think. Find that number.
Yeah, the hidden number.
Nigel, thanks for chatting us out with us. This is great.
Enjoy
we look forward to the next 2 issues.
Yeah. So, until next time, thanks for listening. And thanks, John. And we'll see you later.
All right.